This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Everybody agrees that communication is a basic element of healthcare, but doctors have long been criticized as distant, distracted, and arrogant, while their patients are too often elliptical, embarrassed, and overawed. Learning how to speak and talk to patients used to be called bedside manner, and that dismissive term suggests that it was not regarded as a critical skill. No more. Today, medical schools incorporate programs to ensure doctors learn how to listen carefully and communicate with their patients, and many patients are taking more responsibility for their side of the conversation as well. That's a win-win situation that should improve health care for everybody, but as any journey progresses, the inevitable question arises, are we there yet? Today, on the second part of our series on doctoring in America, communication between patients and doctors. If you're a patient, do your doctors listen well? Do you wish they would do better? And do you feel prepared to talk to your doctor about difficult, perhaps even embarrassing issues? If you're a doctor, we'd like to hear from you as well. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is TOTN at NPR.org. Later in the program, Dan Shapiro will join us. He has the unique perspective as both a patient, he's a cancer survivor, and as a therapist who treats many physicians. His new book, Delivering Dr. Amelia, is about an obstetrician consumed by guilt after she made a serious mistake in the delivery room. But now, the relationship between doctors and patients. Joining us from the studios of member station WBUR in Boston is Dr. Michelle Pugner. She's vice dean for undergraduate medical education at the University of Massachusetts Medical School in Worcester, Massachusetts. She's also a private family physician in Worcester. And welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Neil. It's a pleasure to be here.
You oversee a curriculum for teaching students how to communicate with their patients. What's the backbone of that program?
The backbone of that program is really what we know to be good communication skills, which is learning how to talk to patients, practicing it, getting evaluated on it, and learning how to self-improve. And we try to take that right from the day one of medical school through to the time our students graduate.
There's always seemingly been an attitude that, you know, this wasn't necessary. You know, people know how to do this. You don't have to teach them how to do this.
Well, we're now aware that there really is a science behind the art. And for us, the challenge has been to effectively incorporate that in such a way that students really develop the attitude that that is the case and that they don't take it for granted and that they view communication skills as seriously as they view anatomy, physiology, pharmacology, and all the other, you know, core sciences that are critical to the training of physicians. So we struggle very much to make that attitude happen.
How do you actually do it?
Well, we put them into the real-life situation right from the beginning, and I think the degree to which students see communication skills and good communication skills in action, the more they understand the importance of acquiring them. And so the first important step is to validate that in their curriculum. And we start that often by putting them in our interactions with patients right from the very beginning of medical school.
Real patients?
Real patients.
I understand you also use video.
We use video and we also use standardized patients. But I think if you do talk to students, what they'll say is it's really the interaction with the patient that matters the most to them. And underlying that, behind the scenes, we work with video, standardized patient, role plays, and lectures to give them the practice. But we always have to make sure that they have a context in which to really test it out in practice.
What do you mean by standardized patients?
Well, standardized patients is a term that we use to describe really an educational model for learning how to practice medicine that doesn't use a true patient, but someone who's been trained to become a patient. And these individuals come from all walks of life. Some of them have been and often are patients themselves. Others are professional actors. And others are just people who like to do this sort of thing. And we literally give them the medical background information they need to understand what their roles are and the feedback that they need to give to students to tell them how well the students are doing. And we use them to communicate with students, to test physical diagnosis and all other kinds of issues that are important to clinical skills development in our students.
Mm-hmm. Our phone number, if you'd like to join our conversation, is 800-989-8255. Our email address is TOTN at NPR.org. And let's begin with Amy, who's with us from Shingle House, Pennsylvania.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. My mom was really, really sick right before Easter. She had an undiagnosed pulmonary embolism, and she was diagnosed at the her doctor's office with pneumonia, and she was just sick, 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 and the doctor would call her at home. But my mom's of the generation where you're very stoic, and I don't think my mom was telling the doctor the full truth. And I don't think the doctor was asking the right questions, and she nearly died. But thankfully, she did get through it.
Well, thankfully, we're glad for that, Amy. Generations, is that a big problem, Dr. Pugner?
Yes, it is. And I think part of that comes to understanding the values and the perspective of your patients. And often physicians and students are very well-intended with respect to how they approach their patients, but it's very important that we use the communication encounter not just to give information, like it sounded like what this doctor was trying to do, but to elicit information from the patient and to try to have gotten to a point where maybe Amy's mother might have felt comfortable saying she was unsure or that she was in pain, to create an environment where patients actually feel comfortable with that disclosure.
What I finally did was I called my mother's doctor at home. I know her well through church anyway. She's a family friend and the doctor. And I said, I don't know what my mother is telling you, but she's unable to get out of bed. She cannot breathe. It's not pneumonia. I don't know what's wrong. And she said, well, what are you afraid of? I said, I'm afraid she's going to die in bed.
Yeah.
And she said, okay, we'll get her to the hospital then. And they
may I ask if the doctor was younger or older?
She's in her mid-40s.
So Dr. Pugner, how common are these are the programs like the one you supervise there in Worcester? You know, I don't know about Shingle House, Pennsylvania.
What a 40 like the end of the world.
No, I'm sure it's not. But would a 40-year-old mid-40s physician have typically gone through such a program?
Maybe not, and I think it's very variable depending on where that individual was trained. But I would hope that as we move along with this, that we get to the point where all physicians in training have had that type of experience. So you can learn through a standardized patient as opposed to through a real patient how to negotiate some of those challenges.
Amy, thanks for the call, and wish your mother the best.
Thank you. I will.
Appreciate
Good luck,
it.
Amy.
Bye-bye.
How do you teach somebody to listen?
Well, that's a wonderful question because we struggle with that too. And the most important thing is to first of all tell them that it's important and put them into situations where listening actually makes a difference. So we can actually craft, Neil, scenarios in which if the student doesn't listen carefully or if they don't observe well, they'll actually miss the target. And they'll learn through not having done it the difference that it does make. So we can actually structure scenarios that actually bring that important point out for our students.
And and our doctors also trained, I assume, to look at their patients. I mean, not, you know, obviously not merely at the bruise that they're examining, but at their clothes, their manner, you know, how they're reacting, body language.
Absolutely. And we do, when we write these scenarios and when we go through cases in which we are trying to teach students these skills, build in those aspects. For example, we may specifically state that the individual in this case is not making eye contact with the physician, or whenever the physician mentions a certain member of the family, for example, the patient will turn their head the other direction. And so we ask that that be built into the case, and that way if the student doesn't recognize that, we can then call the attention to the student and help hopefully have them do better the second time around.
Let's get a call from Don, who's with us from Fairfield, Idaho. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay, go ahead, Don.
Yes, in my book, Patient Communication, we talk about that during the first hour of post-trauma, people in fear are very hypersuggestible to the words of a perceived trusted authority, as in a hypnotic state, so that someone could actually do great damage by saying something negative or can do great benefit by saying something positive. I'd like your guest to speak to the hypnotic effect that's been researched in terms of patient communication during that first hour of trauma.
Well, Don, I think you certainly sound like you have a great deal of expertise in this area, and I'll let you know that it is not one of my areas of expertise, but what we do know is that being sensitive to the situation in which the encounter is happening is critically important, so that it would be important for the student right off the bat to identify that this is that type of situation, that the patient has been exposed to excessive trauma or stress, and that they appreciate that right from the get-go so that they can be appreciative of some of the things that you mentioned as being important.
Yes, I mean, even during unconscious situations when people are speaking, the patient can actually hear. And, you know, the most widely used text for emergency mm-hmm. medical care, the text for emergency medical care for the, you know, first aid, they say that you got to be very careful what you say at the scene of an emergency because words, even spoken in jest, can become fixed in the patient's mind and cause untold harm. I think that's the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons says that. And so I think it's not only important not to say negative things, like, oh, my God, that's the worst break I've ever seen.
Right.
But to you realize that if negative things can cause damage, mm-hmm. one can say, you know, when I count to three, I'm going to stop bleeding is an oversimplification. But just that there's a hypnotic effect that is very important for people to learn. And I'm glad to share more with you if you want to.
It'd be wonderful. We're always looking for new cases and new scenarios. And, you know, some of the challenges we now face as a society, for example, that has recently been brought to our attention is just the effect of disasters on human beings and, you know, being able to effectively teach our students how to deal with that. Mm-hmm. Communication has a role to play in just about everything. And as our landscape changes with respect to the demands of healthcare, we also have to adjust how we teach communication at the same time. So these points are very well taken.
Well, thank you. I agree, and I'll happy to email you some information on it if you'd like.
Wonderful. Thank you, Don.
If you send it to totn@npr.org, we'll relay it.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Don.
Bye.
Thanks for the call. Let's hear now from Esther, who's with us from San Jose, California.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Esther.
I was calling because, you know, as our knowledge of science is growing, like, we have an exponential amount of more information they want to teach us as medical students. And therefore, I'm wondering, like, are you willing to give up the minutiae of things like Krebs cycle so we can spend more time working on our communication skills?
I take it you're a medical student.
Yes.
Okay.
What year are you in, Esther?
I'm starting my second year, and the school I go to is actually very good about having us work more on our communication skills. We have a whole class where we do interview, and we have to watch each other do interviews.
What was it, any part of the admissions process, Esther?
Not so much. You do an interview, and at that time they sort of get a feel for your ability to interact with other human beings. They also look for people who've had some sort of clinical experience or volunteer experience. But as for, you know, I don't know, you get some people who you get the feeling, as classmates, have never done anything other than have their head in the book.
Well, Dr. Pugnare, I assume you get a lot of students who say, hey, listen, this ain't brain surgery, I got to concentrate on other things.
Right, and that's part of the challenge, is just as Esther said, it's, you know, medical school is still only 4 years long, and the amount of information is exponentially increasing. So the question is, what is fundamental and what is essential to get across in that critical four-year formative period, and what can we hold back on? And that continues to be a challenge for us. But one of the things that I think is happening in education is that we're increasingly becoming comfortable with not teaching students what to learn or what they need to know, but teaching them how to access the information to be able to answer those questions. So hopefully we will, as we equip our students to better learn independently and identify their own learning needs, some of those minutiae may drop out, and Esther may feel a little bit more relieved with respect to the burden of information that she has to master.
But it is
challenging.
At this time, it's still like hundreds of brain slices and identifying tiny little structures that, you know, we all forgot a week after our exam.
Well, Esther, good luck with your memory in any case.
All right. Thank you very much.
Appreciate the call. When we come back from a break, we'll be joined by the director of the Center for Patient Advocacy for another view on this issue. We're talking about doctors and their patients and communications on Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing communication between doctors and patients. We'd like to hear from you. Our phone number, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is Dr. Michelle Pugner of the University of Massachusetts. She's with us from WBUR in Boston. And joining us now from the studios of member station WETA in Arlington, Virginia, is Terry Hall, Executive Director of the Center for Patient Advocacy. And good of you to join us on Talk of the Nation.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
First of all, briefly, what's the Center for Patient Advocacy? What does it do?
We're a nonprofit grassroots organization, and it's really twofold what we do. We assist patients who are having trouble accessing health care, provide them with information, really try to empower patients, and this segment is right along that line.
Mm-hmm.
And then secondly, we take the patient's message to Capitol Hill on many issues where legislation is maybe needed, or we need to present the patient's message directly to legislators.
Well, getting back to the communications between doctors and their patients, what's the biggest communication problem that you hear about from patients?
I think the biggest one that you hear is that the doctor doesn't listen to what I'm saying, or that the doctor is rushed. And I think we need to keep in mind in this day and age in our healthcare system that a lot of information and a lot of, we cannot just rely on the doctor to be the sole person communicating. It's a two-way street to communicate. And it's very, very important that patients come prepared to doctor visits and really understand their conditions and don't be afraid to ask questions. I mean, there's several things that patients can do to really help the doctor. So it's a two-part communication, and I think that would be the best way for people's health care to get better.
Dr. Pugner, let me ask you about that. Obviously, the stethoscope, the white coat, the clinical surroundings, all of those are intimidating to a lot of people. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely, and I think Terry's point is well taken in that the more physicians can work with patients in a partnership model, not a vertical relationship,
right,
but a parallel relationship, the better the outcome. Because in the end, it's the relationship that really matters. And if the patient can be a part of that, it's a more vibrant and I think a more fulfilling relationship for both the physician as well as the patient.
Yet the other problem, Terry, is that time is becoming less and less a commodity for either party in this conversation because appointments are getting shorter and shorter.
It sure is. And that's why I think it's very important for some things that patients can do right off the bat. If you're going to see your doctor, I mean, write down what you want to say. Write down your symptoms. Write down any lifestyle changes you've had, any medications you're taking. Write down your list of questions that you want to ask the doctor so that when you go in, you may, like you said, it might be intimidating and you only have a certain amount of time. If you are intimidated, you go right to your piece of paper that you brought in with you with the information on it. And then if you do need more time with the doctor, you can always schedule another appointment or even ask the doctor, look, I want to go through all these things. But it's really important for patients not to be afraid of their doctor. If there is a fear there, then that's a whole other problem. But I think I was listening to the earlier segment before I came on, and a lot of elderly patients do have, I think, a little bit more of the communication problem, that they just take exactly what the doctor says as gospel.
I'm here, tell me what's wrong with me.
You tell me what's wrong with me, and they will listen and leave. And then when they leave, they have all these questions, and they're really concerned. And I think that's what we, groups like ours, are really trying hard to get patients to, or even advocates for elderly patients, to get them into this process that they need to ask questions and they need to speak up if they don't understand something. I think that's so important.
Let's get a caller involved. Dr. Chavez joins us on the line from Los Angeles.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
Very well, thanks.
Yes, I teach medical students out of UCLA in my office. And, a lot of physicians aren't really familiar with the different cultures. And so how you talk to people, you have to take into account their cultural and spiritual background. And you have to kind of put yourself in their shoes and try to understand that disease is treated differently amongst different cultures. And I find that a lot of Spanish-speaking patients, for instance, unless you speak to them in Spanish, a doctor through interpreter often gets the wrong story. And, you know, so that's one point. And then the other point would be that when you speak to patients, it's always important to sit down, not look rushed, and basically at the end of your conversation to ask them, have I answered all your questions? Do you understand everything I've said? Is there anything else I can do today? Now, that's only, you know, what I find is that most people don't have much more to say, but they feel that the doctor actually reached out to them and asked them about themselves. And the other times, doctors are too much in a hurry to leave the room, and it only takes 2 minutes more to ask those questions.
Mm-hmm. And just to follow up on what you were saying, Dr. Chavez, I would assume also the way you say that is just about as important as what you're saying.
Well, absolutely. For instance, I deal a lot in pain management. You know, a doctor can come in and say, well, you need a spinal cord stimulator. Another doctor can come in and say, you know, we have these options. A spinal cord stimulator may have these side effects and problems. And too often, patients don't understand, and they believe their doctor feels it's the right course, when in actuality, it's just an option. And sometimes patients get the wrong treatment for their particular situation.
Hmm. Well, Dr. Chavez, thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Appreciate the phone call. We have an email question from Kathy in Wisconsin. I was a mock patient for doctors in training at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, back in the 70s. We patients would get a scenario and symptoms to study. The med students would visit us in our hospital beds and interview us. I hope some of those students chose other professions. Even as a mock patient, I felt they weren't listening to a thing I was telling them. Dr. Pugnair?
Well, that's why we have mock patients, because we hope that what happens is that through this experience, our students do learn, and it's, you know, it's a formative process, and we call that type of feedback formative feedback, so that the student gets to see and hopefully improve the next time around, and that is our goal, to get them there as they develop their skills and move along that continuum. So I would hope that by the end of the line, they did have those skills.
But Terry Hall, there can be a disconnect between what the doctor thinks they're doing and what the patient thinks they're doing.
Oh, sure. I think that's probably common. I think it's also important to know, too, that the classes and things that are, the communication and everything that's being taught now, much showing how much more important it is to the whole healthcare system and for doctors to know this. Most doctors that are out there now probably have not had extensive training in communication. And I think, again, we go back to, as a patient, it is just so important that you are prepared, or that you are willing to speak out and say, you know, I don't understand this, or and really ask questions. And if you don't feel comfortable doing that, take a friend or an advocate with you to the physician in those cases. And I think, too, it depends on what you're seeing the doctor about. If you're going in because you have an earache, or if you're seeing an oncologist for the first time because you've just been diagnosed with cancer, know that there are always other treatment options if you may not get the one that you feel comfortable with. And again, the empowered patient is going to get the best treatment. I really believe that.
Let's talk to Lisa, who joins us from Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Yes, one of the difficulties that I've had with many doctors is their presumption that everyone who sees them is heterosexual. And this can lead to problems in that they either don't ask the right questions or spend time dealing with issues that aren't important. I can't remember how many doctors have tried to convince me I really need to get on birth control so I don't become pregnant.
Go ahead.
I think that's another, if the doctor, I think being up front with the doctor may even solve some of that, too. I think as we go in, let the doctor know up front, you don't need to tell me about birth control anymore. I think it goes back to the patient, too, to really say what you want and let them know what your concerns are. And if they're not addressing what you need to tell them that as well.
But obviously, Lisa, go ahead, Lisa. I didn't mean to interrupt.
The difficulty can be, though, that for many people, the disclosure is something that could threaten their employment or other or other benefit options, and so that the doctors also have to be demonstrate a willingness mm-hmm. to hear
right.
this information
yes.
in a confidential mm-hmm. manner.
Well, the now, whole thing is supposed to be confidential, but go ahead.
Yeah, with HIPAA now, the whole thing should be confidential. All your whatever you discuss with your doctor should stay confidential, and your employer cannot look at those medical records.
I wonder if that's true with the military under the current understanding of don't ask, don't tell policy.
Now, that I don't know.
I don't have an answer for you, Lisa.
Yeah.
If I could just make a comment from that perspective, because
go ahead, Dr. Pugner.
It's something that we think about standardized patients teaching physicians, but patients can teach physicians. And one of the things that we are trying to have our students learn as practitioners is that aspect of reflection. In other words, learning from their interactions to do better so that that educational process continues beyond medical school and residency programs, and so that the patients can actually be partners in helping physicians understand what they need to do to take care of their patients in a better way.
But I was going to say earlier, I think Lisa speaks to the point that, and thanks very much for the call, Lisa, appreciate mm-hmm. it, speaks to the point that so few of us seen the same doctor twice, at least if you're going for, either obviously I'd go into a specialist, yeah. but even seeing, you know, most of us are in various programs where you're not likely to see the same doctor, man or woman again.
And that continuity aspect mm-hmm. is one of the difficulties we have, I think, in our healthcare system in general. And it's something we all have to continue to struggle with, and that we have to be mindful of when we communicate. We have to be able to build and establish that trust very quickly if it's only a one encounter type of situation that we're going to have with our patients.
Mm. Let's go now to Allison, who's on the line with us from Bend, Oregon.
Hi, Neil. It's nice to talk to you.
Thank you.
I've been a nurse for 20 years, and I find that patients ask the nurse all these questions, and you say, well, the doctor will be in to see you. And the doctor comes in, and 2 seconds later, he's out the door, and you come back in, and you say, well, did you get your questions answered? They said no, because they are intimidated by these people. Mm-hmm. And the doctors don't take the time, and they are overworked, and they are overburdened with all the HMOs and stuff. But I also, because I'm in a smaller town, the patients don't believe that they have the right to question the doctor mm-hmm. and say, I need help and this is what I need. And I came from a San Francisco Bay Area where there are the people that stand up and say, you know, this is what I want, this is what I, you know, need. And in the smaller rural areas, it doesn't happen like that.
That goes along with an email question we got from Andrew Hurt in Louisville, Kentucky, who wrote, if the doctor is overwhelmed, there's a good chance their staff is overwhelmed, too. Would it not be prudent to train the staff to listen more efficiently as well?
Well, they try, but we're also, you know, we have to watch out because we aren't doctors. There's also different things that we don't know about out there. And we are in partners and in team with the doctors, but it's hard when we don't have the time to do our continuing education, and neither do they, even though it's required, because we are short-staffed, and we are, you know, the in-services don't happen because there's not enough people, and the reps don't come to the smaller areas like in the big cities.
Hmm.
So it is even harder in smaller areas instead of the metropolitan areas to get the information that we need and the doctors to filter it down because they are so busy. They're pushing, they're doing surgery, hmm. they're seeing 20, 30, 40 patients a day.
Yeah.
And it's very hard. And when you do find the doctor that sits down there and looks at you straight in the eye and takes his time, you can't get in to see their practice because they're closed.
Well, thanks for the call, Allison. We appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We're talking about doctor-patient communications on Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Our guests are Dr. Michelle Pugner, who's the Vice Dean for Undergraduate Medical Education at the University of Massachusetts in Worcester, Massachusetts, and Terry Hall, Executive Director of the Center for Patient Advocacy in Arlington, Virginia. And let's get another call. Amy joins us on a car phone from Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
Good afternoon. It's a stranger you would be on because I was debating walking out of a hospital where my fiance has just had a major surgery on how to deal with a doctor that I feel by body language and overt communication that he's not hearing the questions that I'm asking. And there's been complications that have arisen from the surgery, and I'm very worried. I had a friend whose husband went in with pneumonia and died 2 days later, and so my fears and anxiety is very high, and I'm trying to do this in a manner that I don't insult the physician or isn't, you know, his specialty. I just need my questions answered. And I need to know how to maybe address this communication issue with him. I feel like my questions are clear, but I don't feel like his responses are actually attending to what I'm saying.
Terry Hall, that sounds like that's to you.
Yeah. Well, when you asked him, not to get into to the specifics, but when you do ask a question, is he not answering your question, or is he not answering it in a fashion that you like? Do you see what I'm saying? I mean, is he giving you an answer?
No, I feel, I can only tell you that I feel blown off, and somebody mentioned earlier that one foot out the door kind of syndrome.
Uh-huh.
And I feel like this is a major surgery, and 5 or 10 minutes of his time to ally my fears and my fiance's anxieties is worth the time. And it's, I feel like I'm asking very pointed, intelligent questions.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not, you know, specific kinds of things, and I'm getting kind of, oh, beautiful. You know, it blew me off.
Oh, he's saying, oh, I see.
And that's not helping me any. It's making me feel like I'm not, or my fiance is not an urgent concern, whereas I know he is more with me than the doctor. But mm-hmm. I feel like as a physician that this patient should be as important to him in the same manner.
Sure.
You understand?
Yeah.
Well, what I would do, and Dr. Pugner, please, you know, chime in any time. I mean, immediately I would ask, if you're very uncomfortable right now, I would ask to speak with the doctor again, and maybe you schedule just 5 minutes or an appointment with them. Write down the questions you have, and then if he starts, you know, saying, oh, beautiful, or not answering your questions that you need, be very honest and very respectful to him and say, you know, look, this is, I'm having a problem with the way that we're communicating, and, you know, I need to have answers to these questions, and if we could, you know, work this out so I understand you a little bit better, maybe I'm not communicating to you the way that you want me to. What can we do to work this out so that I can get these answers answers to my questions, and more importantly, that we can get my fiance the health care that he needs. So, I mean, that would be my first thing, to just sit down and really try to talk to him when he's not having a bunch of patients all around him and seems in a rush, even if it takes 5 minutes.
Amy, thanks for the call, and we hope everything works out for the best. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Okay. We just have a few seconds left, mm-hmm. Dr. Pugner, and I wanted to ask you, basically, it sounds like preparation on both sides is key to this.
Absolutely. It is a negotiation. It's a transaction. So the better that both parties are prepared, the better the outcome is going to be. And I think it's wonderful that Terry's doing this work with our patients.
Well, thank you both for joining us today to discuss this important issue. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Dr. Michelle Pugner is the Vice Dean for Undergraduate Medical Education at the University of Massachusetts in Worcester, Massachusetts. She also has a private family practice there in Worcester. And Terry Hall is Executive Director of the Center for Patient Advocacy in Arlington, Virginia. When we come back from a short break, how a medical mistake devastated a young doctor's life, and the person who wrote about it, a therapist who treats physicians but is also a patient himself. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, from the Pew Charitable Trusts, supporting the Project on Medical Liability in Pennsylvania, an independent source of research on medical malpractice at pewtrusts.com, from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, now in its 25th year, and from members of the NPR Legacy Society, helping to guarantee NPR's financial future by including NPR in their estate plans, npr.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Years before he became a TV news anchor, Walter Cronkite's name and his writing were featured on a radio show during the Second World War.
I suppose I should have felt flattered. George S. Patton would have to wait another 25 years before George C. Scott would play him. Here I was, a mere lad of 26, and already being played on the radio by an actor.
Scenes from Soldiers of the Press, later today on All Things Considered from NPR News.